Officials are urging the international community to extend a United Nations arms embargo on Iran. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Ensure that customers and guests wear masks at all times while they are in their premises, except when they are eating and drinking. Ensure that all customers are sanitized before entering the premises. Spreading seat capacity to enforce distancing of 1.5 meters between guests.
That's South African Minister of Tourism on the ground rules for restaurants to start opening. Details coming up also. The first African attempt at finding the vaccine against COVID-19 is expected to gain momentum in South Africa. And some moves Zimbabwe is taking regarding stock market trade and mobile money transfers is unsettling the country's economy. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The first African attempt at finding a vaccine against COVID-19 is expected to gain momentum in Johannesburg, South Africa this week. The scientists leading the study say they'll enroll scores of volunteers this week, building up to a total of 2,000 in the near future. Some will be injected with a placebo, others with the vaccine that's been tested. Darren Taylor has the details.
The study's principal investigator, Professor Shabir Mahdi, says the volunteers will be relatively healthy individuals between the ages of 18 and 65. The infectious disease expert acknowledges that even if the vaccine turns out to be successful, it may still be less effective for elderly people and individuals with underlying conditions such as asthma.
That itself is not a complete disaster, because one of the things that we're hoping to be able to achieve with vaccination is what we call herd immunity.
Mahdi explains herd immunity like this. If the vaccine works to protect a significant threshold of individuals from infection, the coronavirus will lose much of its ability to transmit in the population. This means that COVID-19 will be much less likely to infect even people who aren't vaccinated. Herd immunity will also ensure that people who are more susceptible to the virus, such as the elderly and those with conditions such as diabetes, gain some protection.
So what we believe will happen is that even if this vaccine is not completely as immunogenic and as efficacious in the elderly, in people older than the age of 65, or others with other medical conditions, if we can get at least 60% of the population to develop immunity by vaccination, we will be able to actually reduce the risk even of those individuals that aren't actually able to mount an adequate response to the vaccine.
Professor Helen Rees is an immunization expert and advisor to the World Health Organization. She's based at Wits University in Johannesburg and is one of the scientists trying to find a COVID-19 vaccine. Rees also represents scientific groups trying to develop and distribute vaccines globally, but particularly to poor countries. As such, she's part of the International Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, or CEPI. At the beginning of the year, Rees recalls, CEPI heard about a mystery virus in China.
So in January, we had this emergency meeting to decide whether or not this unknown virus was such a threat that CEPI should invest global funds in developing vaccines. And I recall very clearly that one of the colleagues said, "This could be pathogen X."
At the time, says Rees, most of the medical world didn't realize how serious the new pathogen was.
Now, pathogen X is something that in global health terms we've talked about a lot. And this is the pathogen we've all feared for many years. We all thought it would be respiratory, that it had the potential to spread really rapidly around the world, and that it would cause high mortality.
In January, she and her colleagues didn't know if that was indeed the scenario that was emerging.
But indeed, COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, has turned out to be that pathogen X.
This is why it's so important that a vaccine is found as fast as possible, says Rees, to counter the new waves of coronavirus that scientists expect to sweep the world in the next couple of years. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As the US, EU and Russia called for a ceasefire in Libya and urged the warring sides to resume UN-sponsored negotiations, Tunisian President Kais Saied suggested a national dialogue among Libyan tribes leading to a new constitution. He also called for a new authority to replace the UN-recognized government in Tripoli, which he said had a temporary legitimacy. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, analyzed the Tunisian position for VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi.
Tunisia is right to have its own initiative to its own ends in that it needs to have a higher prioritization of Libya and to be involved in these processes that are going on. Saied is also right about the GNA's temporary legitimacy. Unfortunately, the Eastern government's legitimacy is even more tenuous and temporary, and the political process can't cede without greater international willpower and domestic willpower in Libya and in Tunisia. The Libya conflict is more solvable than Yemen or Syria, as the lead UN official for Libya said, and it should be moved to the top of everybody's priority list because it's more solvable. And she called on the U.S. to do more to herd cats and knock heads, to quote her, to bring together the international actors. But Saied is dead wrong in his approach. He's wrong on the tribes, which have limited powers in the East and South and almost no powers in Tripoli. And as I've been saying for 9 years, the Libyan revolution was very much an articulation against tribes and tribalism. So Gaddafi's attempt to defend authoritarianism using tribes failed. And Haftar's attempt to replicate that is failing. And Saied should know better. So going forward, this approach of seeking authoritarian solutions or tribal solutions is not a good way to go. But as initiatives go, we have Tunisian, Algerian, Moroccan, Egyptian, Emirati, Russian, Italian, French, and German initiatives. But what the German initiative showed us is that they all have to feed back into a UN initiative. Now, the last attempt to have a national conference in Libya was torpedoed by the Eastern General Haftar when the head of the UN Security Council was visiting Tripoli, and that's when he attacked Tripoli. But we have had over three dozen different attempts at national reconciliation in Libya, and in the end, we'll have to have one that's UN-led. And in terms of the international initiative, same thing. We're going to have one that's UN-led, even though Tunisia is the very, very best model for success for Libya in a number of ways, and it has to continue to ramp up, as it's been doing, Libya to the highest level of priority in coordination with the UN, because Tunisia's future depends on Libya and Libya's democratic future depends on Tunisia's.
Tunisian president also said any partitioning of Libya would pose a threat to Tunisia and Algeria. Help us understand why.
Borders are usually the products of war and the negotiations that follow war, rather than negotiations alone. Question here is whether we're going to have a new border in the middle of Libya dividing the country in two, and more importantly, will it be a stable border? No Libyans want that border, very, very few. What they do want is some kind of federalism or confederalism, which is a higher level of autonomy for the states. Now, federalism or confederalism can be unstable, but in the case of Libya, given its historical and contemporary grievances, some level of federalism is probably the most viable solution. Now, the neighboring powers feel very threatened by any breakup, because a two or three state solution for Libya implies that there could be, for example, a more friendly state and a less friendly state. And a less friendly state can be a source of threats. So what outside powers want, even the non-democratic ones, is a consensual, inclusive solution in Libya, which also means that the opposing political forces cancel each other out and reduce the threats to the neighboring states. When you have breakups of countries, you get medieval-type incomes, segmentary-type outcomes, and larger political entities, especially when they're well-governed, tend to be more stable. Also, a larger, stronger Libya means more economic assistance to Tunisia and Egypt, which depend a lot on Libya as a source of both jobs and income. And it helps Algeria with its security threats in the seven countries neighboring Algeria. So a strong central government in Libya help a lot with eradication of terrorism, a strong regional economy, and a fragmented Libya can increase regional tension like a fragmented Yugoslavia or a fragmented Sudan or even the increasingly fragmented European space.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Restaurants in South Africa opened their doors today, 3 months after customers were banned from coming in to curb the spread of COVID-19. Cinemas, casinos, and conference venues also reopened, although under very strict conditions. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, the reopenings occur at a time when experts have predicted COVID-19 infections will peak, but the government says it had to do it to avert a total collapse of the sector.
Businesses in the fast food and restaurants sector breathed a sigh of relief as they welcomed back their sit-in customers. Minister of Tourism Mamaloko Kubai Ngubane has given very strict instructions for reopening. All employees must be screened daily and restaurants disinfected regularly. And restaurants must ensure that those intending to enjoy their food in the restaurants do so under strict rules.
Ensure that customers and guests wear masks at all times while they are in their premises, except when they are eating and drinking. Ensure that all customers are sanitized before entering the premises. Spreading seat capacity to enforce distancing of 1.5 meters between guests. No buffet shall be offered to guests for self-service.
The move has been welcomed by many in the industry. However, Sada Naidu, co-founder of the California Dreaming Restaurant in Durban, says he is worried about the limit of 50 people in the restaurant at a time. He is also worried that they have been banned from serving alcohol.
Opening a restaurant with all sorts of restrictions in terms of numbers, in terms of no alcohol consumption on site, is going to become meaningless for most restaurant owners. You'll find that most businesses and most restaurants will not be able to open because your revenue streams are such that it's a combination between alcohol and food.
However, Grace Harding from the restaurant's collective organization says they are ready to work under the given conditions, since it's the only option for survival for now.
We've already taken steps such as simplifying the menu. There are demarcations on the floor. The training includes all the masking tape. People know they have to be careful, and we've got to keep on reminding our colleagues, our precious staff, our customers and everyone else to be responsible, but it'll take some time. Nothing's going to be instant.
Conference and meeting venues have also been allowed to operate, but only with 50 guests at a time. Casinos are also now permitted to operate under similar conditions. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In moves that have unsettled Zimbabwe's economy, the government first suspended mobile money transfer platforms and halted trading on the stock market, then partially reversed course. Adigando in Bulawayo has the details.
Zimbabwe's government last Friday suspended all mobile money transfer platforms in the country, saying it was undertaking a series of prudent interventions to deal with what it called criminality and economic sabotage by what it called wolves and sheep skin among the populace. The government also said there was proof that phone-based mobile money systems conspired with the help of the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange in illicit activities sabotaging the economy. Among the actions the government cited are illegal international transfers of foreign currency and improperly acting as banks. EcoCash accounts for 94% of all mobile money transfer traffic, and the government says the platform holds in excess of Zimbabwean $8 billion distributed across over 501,000 agent or merchant lines. That money, the government says, is not under the scrutiny of the Financial Intelligence Unit. Following a public outcry, the government partially reversed the ban and will allow individuals to do mobile money transactions. However, all mobile money agent lines are suspended, as well as large payments by businesses with merchant lines. EcoCash was launched in 2011 as the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe was urging the banking sector to find ways to broaden access to financial services for Zimbabweans who could not meet the requirements of formal banks. While it fills the financial services needs for many consumers, its critics say EcoCash agents often charge customers extortionate rates to withdraw funds. Peter Mtasa, the Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Union, says workers are the ones who suffer from the government's policy.
Already the Reserve Bank has whittled down the pronouncement. They've made a U-turn, in fact. But workers are forced to fight illogical government decisions, at the same time indirectly defending a parasitic monopoly. EcoCash has become parasitic. The charges that it charges are very high, and it is also taking advantage of the situation, the cash shortage situation. So for workers, we don't need both. We don't need the government's pronouncement. We also don't need the parasitic bank huge charges that we are losing through EcoCash.
Zimbabwe's government has struggled for years to revive the economy, slow inflation and halt the collapse of its currency. The country's inflation rate is estimated at more than 700% a year. There are shortages of food, medicines, fuel, and many imported goods, and conditions are worsening as the government tries to contain the coronavirus outbreak. Mutasa, however, says workers are suffering because the government has not solved macroeconomic issues and cash shortages, which led to the emergence of mobile money transfer platforms.
We have a terrible situation where workers work for the whole month, and when they get their salaries, they have to buy cash from those who sell cash at 40%. So for every $100 that they work for, they get only $60. And this automatically means salaries that are eroded by inflation, salaries that have been eroded by exchange rate devaluations, are also further discounted by the 40% as a result of cash shortages. So workers are not coping. The cost of living has gone astronomically high. People are starving in their homes, and the cash shortages are adding more misery to the workers. So we need a deeper and more comprehensive solution to the economic crisis, and not these knee-jerk reactions and piecemeal patches that the government is attempting to do, which will actually scatter the little confidence that has been left in the market and cause more problems.
Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
Zimbabwe says it will hold school exams as scheduled starting tomorrow, despite complaints that students, test monitors, and even schools aren't ready due to COVID-19. Reporter Kuzaza Nwashi has the details.
Kane Matema is the Minister of Primary and Secondary Education. He gave an update today on the Zimbabwe Schools Examination Council, or ZIMSEC, examinations.
The Minister of Primary and Secondary Education would like to advise parents, guardians, learners, and the public that the ZIMSEC June 2020 examinations are set to commence as scheduled on Tuesday, the 30th of June 2020.
He assured the public that they have taken precautions to ensure everyone is protected from COVID-19.
The ministry would like to assure the nation that necessary measures have been put in place to ensure that the safety of candidates and invigilators during the course of the examination is of paramount importance.
He says hand sanitizers, thermometers, disinfectants, face masks, and wash facilities have been procured for all examination centers. Robson Chere is the Secretary General of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He says they are concerned.
The level of preparedness in regard to the ZIMSEC being able to conduct our public examinations as from tomorrow is worrisome. We understand that schools were being used as quarantine centers, and as of now, as I report, not all schools have been fumigated or sprayed with the disinfectants.
Tanaka Matiza, the Minister of Education in Zimbabwe in the junior parliament, spoke under oath before the parliamentary portfolio on education.
We have missed almost 4 months of school. As a result, we are not ready for the examinations, whether in June or in November. Exams must take into account the fact that learners have not and will not finish their recommended syllabuses this year.
Chere says what is worse is that test supervisors have not been tested for COVID-19. He says some schools have not received any personal protective equipment. Government gave the responsibility to schools which do not have enough funding. He says, as unions, they will not release their teachers to oversee the exams and expose themselves to such risks. He adds that what is worse is that the paltry salaries of teachers will not allow them to travel to their workstations. Government says the examinations mark the first phase of opening of schools. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Nigeria's envoy to Namibia has provided aid to Nigerians in that country during the lockdown. The mission also helped citizens overcome some challenges in some parts of the country. Mike Mbonye reports from Lagos.
Ambassador Lilian Onu, Nigeria's High Commissioner to Namibia, says there are about 600 Nigerians living in the country, mostly lecturers in the university, medical personnel, school teachers, and other professionals. Onu, who spoke via WhatsApp, says the mission worked with the Nigerian Association to provide support to the Nigerian community.
We tried to see if we could buy food from the Nigerian stores, but most had donated what they had. So all we could do was then donate financially. So the association got a list of the most vulnerable and those most in need. And with that, we were able to know the exact number of people actually in need. And we donated $1,000 for a person. That's what we could do as a mission. But that was supported by all the other things donated by Nigerians.
Ono says issues affecting the welfare of Nigerians are handled by the mission promptly. She says because of the vast size of Namibia, the mission has given accreditation to some officials of the Nigerian Association to undertake consular visit on its behalf.
The association members know each other in the different regions, so they could stay with themselves at a friend's house when they traveled further north or further afield for consular visits, whereas we as a mission, we could not. So we had to accredit them to go to the north, to the south, to the west, where we've had issues. And they have been the best representatives, and they handle consular visits for us where we can't go.
Dr. Jude Osakwe is the president of Association of Nigerians in Namibia. Osakwe, a senior lecturer at the Namibia University of Science and Technology, says the envoy gives priority to members' welfare.
For instance, when one of us was seriously sick last year, she made sure he was taken care of and bought tickets for him to be flown back home to Nigeria. When we lost a Nigerian citizen here some months back, she sent money for the funeral since we couldn't take the body back home due to the lockdown. She also made available transport for us to attend that same funeral. She makes sure Nigerian immigration officers visit Namibia every year for the renewal of passports of Nigerian citizens.
Osakwe says Ambassador Nu also gave the association a building to teach Nigerian children the three major languages in Nigeria. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Sports
fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA